So hopefully we kind of all know the basic idea of Bell's theorem. You start off. I thought it was on. There's a green light. I can speak a bit louder if you want. How's that? Okay, so you start with some words, locality, yada yada yada. Eventually, those words lead you to write down an equation like this. Once you've got an equation like this, you can derive Bell inequalities, and then you go and do your experiment and try and violate the Bell inequality. And then the lesson is supposed to be that one of the words you said at the start was wrong. So this was sort of the state of the art 50 years ago. And what's happened since, I think, is the sort of understanding we've got of this second step has really improved quite dramatically. So we now understand things like the polytope of local correlations. We understand that the Bell inequalities are facets of that. We can write computer programs that spit out Bell inequalities at us. There's now an online database of Bell inequalities. So I think we're really getting the hang of this part of the argument. And as well as that, there's been a whole new step added, which is that you actually use the violation of the Bell inequality to do something interesting, like to securely distribute keys or to certify that you've generated randomness. So that's all great. What about this first step? Well, I think during Bell's lifetime, he actually finessed this first step quite a lot. And by the end, in his sort of La Nouvelle Cuisine paper, he really gave a very clear explanation of, starting with the sort of basic idea of local causality, how you can get to this equation. But since Bell, I think it's been a bit of a mixed bag, maybe two steps forward, one step back, or one step forward, two steps back, something like that. There's been a lot more words, things like measurement independence, setting independence, parameter independence, locality, determinism, predeterminism, superdeterminism, free will, free choice. I mean, it goes on and on. And I think it's really only quite recently that that we've at least got back to understanding this as well as Bell did. And I think that's actually thanks to some of the people in this room. So here's what I currently think the best version of this first step is. And the trick is don't lean so heavily on words. Draw a picture. So draw a picture like this. X and Y are the settings, A and B are the outcomes, lambda's the hidden variables. And then just say that this picture means what it normally means. In case you don't know what a picture like that normally means, there's been this sort of theory of causality developed, which is based on directed acyclic graphs. And the kind of definition of what they mean basically is called the Markov condition. And it says that your probability distribution should factorize like this. So in the case of this dag I just drew, well, the parents of A are X and lambda. So we need P of A given X lambda. Parents of B are lambda and Y, and so on. And this is pretty much what we need. So I think that this is really the kind of the key step in that first part of the argument. There are various ways you could motivate these two assumptions. For example, the standard way to get to the first one is to talk about special relativity. That prevents there, for example, being an, if you do the experiment at space-like separation, that prevents there being an arrow going from X to B. You still need to argue that there isn't, for example, a common cause of lambda and Y. And for that, there's normally some hand-waving about conspiracies or something like that. But there are other ways you can get this. For example, there's a paper by Wood and Speckens where they show that this is the only DAG that doesn't violate a principle of no fine tuning. And hopefully, by the end of this talk, you'll see a third reason for using this DAG, which is that this is basically the DAG we've got in mind when we write down a quantum model for a Bell experiment. The second thing, it's less clear exactly how you motivate it. I mean, this theory of causality has been extremely successful in lots of other fields, so that's a good reason. Often people just kind of shout at you something about science demands that the probabilities have to factorize like this or something. So for me, it's the second assumption that we should be thinking about more carefully. I think the first one is pretty rock solid. But there are people who think, no, the response to Bell's theorem is really to modify this DAG, right? If you think there's, say, some preferred rest frame where things can happen instantaneously in that frame, then you'll quite happily draw arrows going from X to B and then from Y to A, and you're not going to be able to get Bell inequalities anymore. So if you're one of those people, whenever I draw a DAG, I'm not drawing the real DAG, I'm drawing the sort of effective DAG or the operational DAG or something like that. Hopefully you might come to realize that this DAG, in a lot of ways, acts like the causal structure. And so maybe it just is the causal structure. Okay. So what am I actually going to talk about? Well, if I'm going to say that I want to stick with that DAG in a Bell scenario, yeah?
And the general point. You would make, I think, a distinction between having an arrow from X to A and an arrow from A to C, and then whether or not you allow an arrow from X to C, you would regard those as different DAGs, I believe.
Yeah.
I mean, they would be mathematically different. But as far as the causal structure is concerned, there's really no distinction.
Yeah, so I'm not using causal structure in the relativistic sense. Maybe it's a bad term. I really just mean which things actually have a causal influence on which other things.
Right,
which is...
I'm just saying relativity gives us no basis for assuming that there's no direct influence from this X to this hypothetical C.
No.
Only to combine it with some notion of locality would you have to be able to draw that conclusion.
I mean, there might be all sorts of things that... No, it's not.
What's obvious is you shouldn't have arrows from space like dimensions. But exactly that you better have arrows among time like dimensions, that's not obvious.
Yeah. But the interpretation of these pictures is when you draw an arrow, you think there's actually a causal influence operating from the start of the arrow to the end of the arrow. So you probably shouldn't draw such an arrow if relativity doesn't let you, but just because relativity lets you doesn't mean you have to draw an arrow. So this is a different thing from just what you get from relativity.
Before you go on, I thought this was supposed to be sort of definitive, kind of causality.
bears on how to get, how this graph of those two the derivation of the quality of quantity.
Exactly. These aren't two separate assumptions that you can just drop one and happily keep the other. If you just completely drop the second assumption, then you've literally said nothing by drawing the first picture. Okay? So the second assumption is what allows you to start with this picture and actually say something about correlations. And equally, if you just take the second assumption and refuse to say anything about what the DAG is, then you're also not going to say anything about correlations. So I'm not suggesting that one of these just gets dropped wholesale. I'm saying that the response to Bell's theorem, if you're still going to say anything about correlation, you either need to modify the first assumption or modify the second assumption. And so in particular, if you modify the second assumption, then drawing this picture is going to mean something different than what it means when it gets you local causality.
And just to extend, I think no one would think that this is true microscopic directed exponential graph. There's some gap between X and A. So normally there'd be a whole bunch of intermediate events, a much more complicated pattern.
An arrow doesn't mean that there isn't anything in between. It just means a causal influence from one thing to the other.
If you draw a direct line from X to A,
No, this isn't a picture of the entire world. This is a picture of five variables that we're interested in. And that's the causal relationships between those variables. Okay. Well, I'll just try and call it a DAG from now on. Okay. So if the plan of attack is to keep the DAG as it is in the Bell scenario, then if we just adopt the standard definition of what that DAG means, we get the Bell inequalities are violated, stuck. So for this to work, we need a different definition of what the DAG means. And that's the first thing I'm going to tell you about. And then, as a kind of first step to show that this is a sensible generalization, I'll show that a very central result from the causality literature carries over to this new definition. I'll talk about something that we found quite surprising, which is that there are still quantitative limits on correlations, even if you're not assuming local causality or really assuming much about your physical theory at all. And finally, I might get a chance to talk about trying to classify which DAGs you should be interested in if you're interested in quantum foundations. Yes. So before I generalize the interpretation, I'm actually going to generalize the DAGs slightly. There's now going to be two types of nodes, triangles and circles. And to begin with, just think of the triangular nodes as being observed variables and the circular nodes as being hidden or latent variables. And so if you're asked for the probability distribution for this DAG, you'll start with the usual expression, and then you'll just integrate out lambda, which is the standard thing you would do in a Bell scenario, because the hidden variables are hidden. But this distinction is going to be amplified in the new definition. So just as an example of why it's useful to have this kind of definition, people have started to think about more complicated scenarios than the original Bell scenario. For example, these guys talked about something they called bilocality, which they were using to study entanglement swapping experiments. So the idea is you have two sources of entangled particles, you have someone doing an entangled measurement on them, that then creates entanglement between the remaining two parties, and then they can violate a Bell inequality, for example. And the way they wanted to model that classically was having independently distributed hidden variables for the two entangled sources. But they also look at quantum models, and there they use a product state of two. So they use a product state between these two sources. And you might even want to consider other theories in this scenario as well. So it's kind of pretty natural when you look at a particular scenario to think, well, what would a classical model look like? What would a quantum model look like, et cetera? But to start proving general theorems, you really need to nail down the definition of what you're talking about. So to do that, we tried to keep everything as general as possible, and we found it was useful to use the framework developed by these guys for talking about general physical theories. What they call an operational theory is this thing. I guess Lucian would say it's something like you can draw circuit diagrams and some of the boxes have lights on them that flash to give you particular outcomes. So this is just saying things like you can run two boxes in parallel, you can put one box after another, that sort of thing. Nothing very substantive, yeah. And then they call it an operational probabilistic theory if, when you've got a closed circuit with nothing going in and nothing coming out, you can actually calculate the probability of some particular sequence of lights flashing. And if you do some experiment here and some experiment here, the probability should just be the product of those two things. And then finally, they call it a causal operational probabilistic theory. If there's only one way of getting rid of a system. So if there's only one for each type of system, if there's only one type of box that takes that system in and then spits nothing out, doesn't have any lights on it, just does nothing, then they call that a causal theory. Another way of putting it is that if you have some random preparation followed by a random measurement, then the choice of which measurement you perform shouldn't affect the probabilities for the preparation. Or yet another way of putting it is that there's a unique deterministic effect. So some of you might be familiar with other frameworks that people have used to talk about general physical theories, general probabilistic theories. There's a tendency to make some extra assumptions as well. So just to be clear, these causal operational probabilistic theories don't necessarily have to be convex. They don't necessarily have to be locally tomographic. And they don't, there could be measurements that aren't in the theory, even though it's mathematically consistent to imagine them being in a theory. Quite often there's this assumption that the entire dual cone of the effects is available as measurements. We're not assuming anything like that. In fact, we're not really using any kind of linear structure at all. So pretty much the key example is going to be quantum theory. So quantum theory can naturally be cast as a causal operational probabilistic theory in this framework. Happens to be all three of these things as well, but that's fine. Okay, so our new interpretation of one of these DAGs that now has two types of nodes, circular nodes and triangular nodes, is a little bit hairy. So the first thing you do is you look at all the edges that are coming out of circular nodes, and those get associated with types of system. If you were doing quantum theory, those would get associated with Hilbert spaces. And now nodes are going to get what they call tests. You can just think of them as boxes operationally. In quantum theory, they'd be quantum instruments, a collection of CP maps summing up to a trace preserving map. And the circular nodes don't have any outcomes. Okay. And finally, which test you perform can depend on the value of any triangular parents of that node. Okay. It's a little bit hard to get your head around. So just going back to this example of the Bell scenario, there are two edges coming out of that circular node. So we're going to need two physical systems. That circular node is going to correspond to some preparation or some state on that on those two systems. The nodes A and B are going to be measurements, but there's also going to be just classical random variables X and Y that are just sampled completely independently. And then which measurement is performed at A and B depends on the value of X and Y. So hopefully you can roughly see how you get from one to the other. And in particular, in the case of quantum theory, this is just exactly what people always write down in a Bell scenario. It's just an entangled state with product measurements. Edges? Yes. No, I'm really thinking of them as two. So EA is a POVM on the first Hilbert space, EB is a POVM on the second Hilbert space, and rho is a state on the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces. If you like. So in this picture, because this is now drawn within the operational theory, a line is just a Hilbert space, okay? And so you can just see that if there's multiple lines coming out of a single box, then you just take the tensor product of those Hilbert spaces. So rho is a state on the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces, but then the measurements, the first measurement just acts on the first Hilbert space, the second measurement just acts on the second Hilbert space. If you like, yeah. It's really just the standard way of modeling a Bell experiment. So just a few sanity checks that this definition isn't completely off the rails. If all of the nodes are triangles, remember the triangles are the ones that actually have random variables on that give you outcomes. If all of your nodes are triangles, you just get back to the standard classical definition. Also, this framework for general theories includes classical probability theory as a special case. So if you consider that special case, then, and you apply it to a DAG that has triangles and circles, you again just get the standard classical thing, but where the circles, the variables on the circles are integrated out, just like lambda was integrated out in the Bell scenario. So I think it is fair to call this a generalization of the standard definition. So now I want to talk about a result that's very useful in the existing theory of causality, which is something called deseparation. So deseparation is all about conditional independence. So you say that X is conditionally independent of Y given Z, and write it like this. If the conditional probability of X and Y given Z factorizes into the conditional probability of X given Z and Y given Z. To put it another way, for somebody who knows Z, learning X doesn't tell them anything about Y. So, for example, if we considered one of these bilocality scenarios, just by kind of eyeballing it, you'd probably expect, for example, that let's say you've performed the measurement in the middle at B, so you've swapped your entanglement and you're now just basically doing a Bell experiment, and Alice knows what settings she's going to put in on her end, you would expect that her outcome shouldn't tell you anything about Charlie's setting. Okay, this is just the standard no signaling principle. Another thing you would expect is that if you don't know what the result of the measurement in the middle is, then A and C should be independent, because basically if you trace out Bob, you're just left with a product state for Alice and Charlie. So there's no way to get any correlations between those guys. But once you condition on Bob's outcome, now you do expect A and C to be correlated. That was the whole point of doing the entanglement swapping. So the idea of deseparation is to just have a way of looking at a DAG and saying which nodes should be conditionally independent of which nodes, given which nodes. Unfortunately, it's a slightly scary looking condition. So first you need a notion of a path being blocked. So this isn't necessarily a directed path. So you just start on some node, you just go along edges to some other nodes. Doesn't matter which direction. Doesn't matter if you're going against an arrow or with an arrow. And then you say that that path is blocked by some set of nodes Z if it passes head to head through a node that's not in Z. So you've got your path, it's going through various nodes, and then say here it hits something and it goes off like this. This bit here is called head to head because these arrowheads are next to each other. So this path is going head to head through this node. And then if this node is not in Z, and none of its descendants are in Z, then you say that this path is blocked by Z. And then a path can also be blocked if it passes any way other than head to head through a node that is in Z. So, for example, if your path comes in like that, goes through something that is in Z, and then comes out, that's going to be, this path is going to be blocked by Z. And then the deseparation condition is just that every path, X is deseparated from Y by Z, if every path from X to Y is blocked by Z. So in the classical case, using that original Markov condition that I showed you right at the start, this deseparation condition is really as good as you want. If X is deseparated from Y by Z, then X and Y are conditionally independent given Z in any probability distribution that's compatible with that DAG. And if X and Y aren't deseparated by Z, then there exists a probability distribution compatible with that DAG where X is not conditionally independent of Y given Z, which is the most you can hope for, because if you just took completely uncorrelated variables on everything, that would be compatible with any DAG and would have loads of conditional independences.
Yeah. Z was supposed to be an arbitrary set of
nodes. X, Y, and Z are all arbitraries. Non-overlapping sets of nodes. So maybe it would help to actually just do a really simple example. If you've got this DAG and you're interested in whether, maybe I should stick to the same notation, whether X and Y are conditionally independent given Z, you just look at all the paths from X to Y. There's only one, it's this path. You look, does it go through a node that's in Z and it's not head-to-head there? Yes. So X and Y are deseparated given Z, so you would expect X and Y to be conditionally independent given Z. And since the meaning of this DAG is that the probabilities factorize like that, it's not too hard to see that indeed X and Y do have to be conditionally independent given Z. So what we wanted to do was to extend this result to our new generalized understanding of what a DAG means. So we've only got classical variables and the triangular nodes. So we're just interested in if this set of triangular nodes is deseparated from this set of triangular nodes by some other set of triangular nodes, does that mean that the corresponding conditional independence holds, where that conditional independence is just the completely standard thing? So the part that says that if deseparation doesn't hold, the conditional independence doesn't always hold, that we just get for free because classical probability theory is an example of a generalized probabilistic theory. So the examples that these guys came up with to show that there are probability distributions that don't have any additional conditional independences, we can just take those. The hard bit is showing that it's still true that when X is deseparated from Y by Z, the conditional independence has to hold. So we only associate random variables with the triangular nodes. The circular nodes are like one outcome tests, so they don't have a random variable associated with them. So, for example, in this bilocality scenario, it is indeed the case that A is deseparated from Z by Bx. It is indeed the case that A is deseparated from C. That's pretty easy. The only path from A to C is this one, and that goes head to head through B, which you're not conditioning on. But then it's not true that A and C are deseparated by B, because that goes head to head through a node that you are conditioning on. So it's very plausible that this is going to generalize. So the obvious thing to do would just be to take the existing proof and just try and fiddle around with it a bit and get a proof for this more general case. Unfortunately, that's not really possible. The way the existing proof works is if you just have a completely classical DAG, then every node is conditionally independent of its non-descendants given its parents. That's an equivalent way of stating the Markov condition. And then what they do is they show that starting with that and using certain properties that conditional independences obey, you can derive any of the other conditional independences that follow from deseparation. But we don't really have the luxury of doing that, because on these circular nodes, we don't have a random variable. So we're not even sure what it would mean to say that the circular node is conditionally independent of its non-descendants given its parents. So because we've kind of almost handicapped ourselves by only putting random variables on the triangular nodes, this existing proof that's kind of this very local strategy of starting with the independences at each node and building them up into whatever conditional independence you want on the whole thing, it's not at all clear how you could generalize that. Yeah. Yeah. Not sure I can quite put my finger on why that wouldn't work. I'm pretty sure it wouldn't, but yeah, that was going to be pretty much what I said. So if you just take this DAG, and then you applied our definition, say, using quantum mechanics, then this would mean preparing a bipartite entangled state and then doing a measurement on each half of it. And generically, that would result in a correlated distribution on these two guys. But if you then put a variable here, yes, that's the problem. So if we were going to say, oh, well, I'm just going to dump a trivial variable here and then try and stick with the standard strategy, well, then you'd have to say that B is conditionally independent of its non-descendants given its parents, which would mean B would have to be independent of A given its parent. But its parent is just a trivial variable, so that would just mean B has to be independent of A. So it's not that these guys don't do anything, it's just that we're not attempting to sort of describe explicitly what they're doing. So we just need a way to kind of sidestep around them. Uh, I mean, a causal operational probabilistic theory, as I went through the definition of. So in general, there would just be some type of system here, some type of system here, and then an arbitrary bipartite state on those systems. I went through it very quickly. what it actually is it's a transformation from the trivial system. Down here, you can imagine there's a trivial system. It's a transformation from the trivial system to these two systems. And you can just define state to be shorthand for a transformation from a trivial system. They have to compose in natural ways, and the final thing has to be a probability. People talk about Boxworld a lot, which is like a theory where you can have any no signaling correlations. Pardon? So in Boxworld, let's say these two things were the simplest system. The simplest system is one that's just described by two different measurements. And then this thing here would just be a state on those two guys, which is any probability distribution over pairs of such measurements that satisfies the no signaling condition. I mean, it's really like.
Well, we could think of it as something that emits two boxes in the
way. You could just think of this as being some box where you press a button and two things come out of it. And then this is just a box where something goes into it and a light flashes. Yes, I guess. I mean, it's not actually defined like that, but that would probably be enough to specify one. Another example would be Rob's toy theory. Because we're not assuming anything like convexity, it fits into this framework as well. Okay, so we need to do something a bit different. But it turns out that if you just try it in a specific case, it always seems to work fairly easily. So this is the translation of the DAG I've been drawing for the bilocality scenario into a circuit diagram in the operational theory. So rho and sigma are your, in quantum theory, they would be your entangled states. EA, EB, and EC are the measurements that Alice, Bob, and Charlie are performing. What Alice does should depend on X, and what Charlie does should depend on Z. Let's say you're interested in, is A independent of C? Well, then the first thing you need to do is, this just defines a great big probability distribution on X, A, B, C, Z. So you need to sum over X, B, and Z to get the probability distribution on A, C. If we sum over X, we're just adding up a probability distribution, we're gonna get one. If we sum over Z, we're just gonna get one. And if we sum over B, then what we're left with is some one outcome measurement. And the causal assumption is that there's only one such measurement. So I'll just call that E. And now a consequence of this assumption that there's only one sort of trivial measurement is that the trivial measurement on a composite system is the same as the trivial measurement on each of its subsystems, which means we can split the measurement apart like that. And now, part of the definition of an operational probabilistic theory was that if you take two closed circuits next to each other, the probabilities is just the product of the probabilities for each of them. So we've got the factorization we were looking for that says A is independent of C. And so you can try this for other independences in the bilocality scenario. You could try it for other DAGs. You always seem to get the factorization you need. The hard bit is proving that deseparation actually implies that this will always happen. And the way we ended up doing it was actually coming up with a different characterization of deseparation that's kind of more about the nodes splitting into distinct sets. It's equivalent to the standard definition. And once you've got this new formulation, it's a lot easier to see that the circuits are always going to factorize like this. One last thing I wanted to say about this deseparation criteria is that if you have two triangular nodes that are correlated, i.e., so you've got A and B, and A is not independent of B, then it must be that A is not deseparated from B by this theorem. And if you think about how two nodes could fail to be deseparated, the only options is that there's a directed path from A to B, there's a directed path from B to A, or there's some node, some third node that has a directed path both to A and to B. So in other words, if A and B are correlated, A is a cause of B, B is a cause of A, or there's a common cause of A and B. So that shows that this new definition is still kind of capturing some of the content of Reichenbach's principle, which is what the standard definition of the Markov condition is really supposed to be doing. No, because of this business about the distinction between head-to-head and... Yeah, I mean, there's a very strong connection in that we wouldn't have been able to prove this without using the causality condition. That was what allowed me to factorize the deterministic effect. Yes, because the way they actually justify the causality condition is they say, consider an experiment where you're randomly choosing what state to prepare. And then you're randomly choosing what measurement to perform. You would expect that your choice of measurement should not affect which preparation you do. And indeed, in this DAG, X and Z are deseparated. And so since their causality condition is just a way of enforcing that choices of measurements don't affect preparations, you're going to need to have the causality condition in order for deseparation to imply conditional independence. Although, okay, That's the kind of just so story. It's a little bit more subtle in that if you look very carefully at our definition of what of how we interpret these DAGs, I said that the test you can perform here depends on which outcome. So you just sample your probability distribution Z, and then you use that to decide which test to perform. And actually, in their paper, they show that for it even to be well defined to consider choosing an operation based on the result of a previous operation, you already have to have the causality condition. So really, you couldn't even apply our definition without having the causality condition. But I think this is kind of the intuition of why it's connected. Okay, so that was the kind of boring stuff. We generalized a definition, we generalized a theorem, yay. Something we were a bit more surprised about, and in fact, I think really what got us started on this project, was realizing that under our definition, a DAG can tell you more than just conditional independences. So in the Bell scenario, if you take any set of any probability distribution that satisfies the conditional independences, which are essentially the no signaling conditions, then you can concoct some generalized physical theory that gives you those correlations. So in the Bell scenario, in general, if you don't know what physical theory you're using, the only thing you learn from writing down the DAG is just the conditional independences, basically the no signaling conditions. And so you might expect that the same thing would hold in general, that if you don't know what physical theory you're using, the only thing you can learn is these conditional independences that you get from deseparation. But it turns out that's not the case. So a nice example is this scenario, which is you've got three parties, Alice, Bob, and Charlie. And Alice and Bob share some bipartite state. Alice and Charlie share some bipartite state. Bob and Charlie share some bipartite state. But there's no tripartite state that all three of them get to use. So if you think about the deseparation criterion, I can get from A to B, and whether or not I condition on C, that path is unblocked. Similarly for any other pair of variables. So when I draw this DAG, I'm not giving you any conditional independences at all on A, B, and C. So you might expect that if you don't know what physical theory I'm talking about, then absolutely any probability distribution on A, B, and C is possible. But actually, that's not the case. And a nice example of something that isn't possible is having A, B, and C being perfectly correlated bits. Okay, so if I just take the probability distribution that with probability half, Alice, Bob, and Charlie all output 0, and with probability half, Alice, Bob, and Charlie all output 1, then no matter what theory you're considering in that very general framework that we started off with, there's no way to produce that probability distribution using this causal structure. So for in the case that you're considering the physical theory you're considering is classical, or if you're considering a local hidden variable model for this case, Tobias already showed that. And so what we basically did was generalize that and show that the assumption of classicality isn't needed there. The perfect correlation is impossible in any theory in this framework. So I'll try and give you an idea of how the proof goes. The main trick is actually not too hard. So the first thing is just to translate the DAG into a diagram in your operational theory using this prescription that we've given. So that's what I've done here. Rho, sigma, and tau are those bipartite states I was talking about. And then A, B, and C are now the measurements where each person gets their two things in. So Alice gets half of rho and half of sigma, does some, in general, joint measurement on those. Bob gets his half of rho, his half of tau, does some joint measurement, and so on. So that's just our definition of what this DAG means. But then, if you could, okay, so let's suppose that the probability distribution we were considering was this one I talked about, where A, B, and C are perfectly correlated bits. And now let's suppose that someone says, I've come up with a physical theory that produces that probability distribution. So, and in my physical theory, all you need to do is use the states rho, sigma, and tau, and certain measurements EA, EB, and EC, and I promise you, you'll get those probabilities. Well, if they've done that, then you could also consider this scenario, where the only thing I've done is I, instead of sigma going to Alice and Charlie, Alice now just gets her reduced state of sigma, and Charlie just gets his reduced state. Is that, it's maybe a little bit hard to see if you're not used to these diagrams. So in the case of quantum theory, what I'm saying is that instead of using sigma AB, I'm using the reduced state on Alice tensor the reduced state on Bob. Okay, that's what this diagram would mean in quantum theory. Okay, so if they've given you the first thing, then they should be able to give you the second thing as well. But now, this second thing is basically this bilocality scenario I've been talking about. Alice and Bob share some bipartite state. Bob and Charlie share some bipartite state. But there's nothing going on between Alice and Charlie, because instead of giving them an entangled state, we're just giving them a product state. So that means that either just by looking at this or by applying our deseparation criteria, A has to be independent of C. And then the final ingredient is that if you're only interested in, say, the marginal distribution on Alice and Bob, so if you don't care what outcome Charlie got, then it doesn't matter which of these two diagrams you use. If you imagine summing over C in the first diagram, you'll end up with exactly the same expression as if you sum over C in the other diagram. Basically, the change we've made only affects the correlations between Alice and Charlie. It doesn't affect the correlations between Alice and Bob. And likewise, it doesn't affect the correlations between Bob and Charlie. So if it was the case that in your original thing, Alice was perfectly correlated with Bob, that's still going to be the case in the second thing. And if it was the case in the first thing that Bob was perfectly correlated with Charlie, that's still going to be the case in the second thing. But now you've got a contradiction, because if Alice is perfectly correlated with Bob and Bob's perfectly correlated with Charlie, then Alice is perfectly correlated with Charlie, which is impossible in the second case. So the conclusion is that they were lying and there is no way of achieving this perfect correlation. So if you observe perfect correlation between three parties, you can rule out this causal structure where each of them has bipartite common causes without really assuming anything at all about the physical theory that's involved. Okay, so the last thing I want to talk about is we've now got this definition of these DAGs that have these triangular and circular nodes. But, you know, there's a huge number of DAGs that you might draw. What are the ones that are actually going to be interesting? And what are the ones that are going to be less interesting? Well, first of all, what do I mean by that? There's kind of a lot of stuff about the Bell scenario that, you know, is either folklore or is just a throwaway comment in a paper. One thing everyone knows is that if you use a separable state, you can't violate a Bell inequality. And in R formalism, you would write a separable state like this. Basically, if I, this first bit of the diagram is just going to be turned into some probability distribution over I, some state here that depends on I, and some state here that depends on I. Okay, which is just a separable state. So we know that this DAG is boring. But what does boring mean? Well, it doesn't mean that this DAG doesn't tell you anything. It's still true that, you know, Bob can't learn Alice's setting, Alice can't learn Bob's setting, for example. The no signaling conditions still hold. And you can say other things, for example, A and B are conditionally independent given I. So it's not that this DAG doesn't say anything, but I think the real reason why this is boring is because it doesn't tell you anything except conditional independences. In particular, even if you only allow classical theory, so even if the physical theory you're considering is classical, you can achieve absolutely any probability distribution as long as it satisfies the necessary conditional independences. So there's no hope of seeing any probability distribution and saying, oh, this means that something interesting in quantum is going on. Because even if you're using quantum mechanics, you still have to satisfy the conditional independences. And I've just said that once you satisfy the conditional independences, there's a classical model for what's going on. So the reason that this DAG is boring is that the set of things you can do classically is the entire set of things that have the right conditional independences. So it's the whole kind of universe of conceivable probability distributions. Here's another thing people know are boring, a Bell scenario where one party gets to choose which measurement to do, but the other party just does a fixed measurement. Again, it's not boring because you can get any probability distribution. It's boring because even classically, you can get any probability distribution where X is independent of B, the no signaling condition. So what we want to identify which DAGs are interesting and which are boring is to understand when is it the case that using classical probability theory, you can produce any probability distribution that has the conditional independences implied by deseparation. If it's the case that you can achieve everything classically, then there's no hope of any kind of interesting quantum advantage or anything like that. Whereas if it's not the case that you can achieve anything classically, then maybe you can achieve some more interesting stuff using quantum mechanics or using some other theory. So this is really the fundamental distinction in this framework, is those DAGs where classically you can achieve everything and those DAGs where classically there are limits. Okay, in that case, I'll just say what we've come up with. We've come up with a condition that is sufficient for the DAG to be boring. In other words, if this condition is satisfied, then you know that classically you can already do everything. And it looks like, at least for small DAGs, it may also be necessary, but we haven't proved that. And so if you just apply this condition, you can try it, you can look at, consider all the DAGs that only have one node. Turns out our condition says all of those are boring. It says all the DAGs that have two nodes are boring. It says all the DAGs that have three nodes are boring. It says that the only interesting node DAG with four nodes is this one. And interestingly enough, it was already noticed in the classical causality literature that this DAG has consequences other than conditional independences. There are basically bell-type inequalities in this scenario. They're called instrumental inequalities. And this is kind of explaining why this is the one they came up with. It's actually the smallest interesting case. If you go to size 5, most of what you're going to get is just this with some pointless extra node dangling off somewhere. The new things you get when you go to size 5 are these two guys. Which is, the one on the left is the Bell scenario. Yeah? Yes. Yeah, so you prepare an entangled state. Alice does some randomly chosen measurement. She sends her outcome to Bob, and then Bob does a measurement based on Alice's outcome. Yeah. In this scenario, there's a separation between classical and quantum, just like there is in the Bell scenario. So size 5, there's this Bell thing, and then there's this other interesting looking thing that I don't really know anything about. And then size 6, there's a lot more, and size 7 would probably blow up my computer. So I'll leave it there.
So when you were talking about the triangle, you said that there are constraints other than conditional independences. The way I'd understand that is that actually there's some missing notion of conditional independence, which is conditional independence of triangle. If everything was classical in that network, then there would be some deseparation. Mm-hmm. And is that not the way? Perhaps what's missing is just the conditional.
Yeah. Yeah, so there are no interesting DAGs where everything is a triangle, because in that case, it's just the classical Markov condition, and the Markov condition is just a conditional independence condition. So if there was some way of generalizing the Markov condition that sort of used a concept of conditional independence that had been suitably generalized to things like quantum theory, then presumably in that case, it would also be true in the Bell scenario that the only limit is some sort of conditional independence, and Bell inequalities would just turn out, sorry, Cyrilson inequalities would just turn out to be some kind of consequence of conditional independence.
These
DAGs should be at least mildly interesting, even to someone who only cares about classical theory, because this tells you, if you don't have access to some of the variables, when can looking at the other variables tell you things other than conditional independences, right? Even classically, they were interested in that four-node DAG that I drew. Only where there's latent variables.
Only when there's
latent variables.
Right. But you know, in the triangle example, I can come up with a distribution that has all and only conditional independences that the separation criteria imply, and that distribution would still be forbidden because it exhibits too much correlation between A, B, and C. So in a classical context, you can distinguish the consequences of the causal structure for conditional independence related, and then there's other consequences of the causal structure for strengths of the correlations. And that's the stuff that the best causal inference algorithms fail to take account of. And so it seems to me that you could first of all ask a different question about the generalized case, which is which of these DAGs are that all the consequences are encoded in conditional independence relations. So that's presumably going to be a larger set. And then your question is more, how many of these have consequences beyond the consequences that you would have seen from the classical?
No. This classification is purely trying to understand when is the set of things you can do classically the entire set of probability distributions that has these conditional independences. So it's exactly the question you said. When are there consequences of the causal structure? When are there classically constraints from the causal structure other than conditional independence?
It could be a connection, right? So the Bell structure, for example, is one wherein Bell's argument shows that there are consequences of the causal structure beyond the conditional independences.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the ones that you can find the distinction between quantum and classical. So
this is nothing to do with quantum.
Well, okay, sorry. I distinguish between the post-classical, i.e. this general framework.
No, we're not even trying to do that. We're just trying to identify when there's a difference between what you can do classically and the set of all things that have the conditional independences.
Right.
The set of all things that have the conditional independences is in general bigger than even the set of things you could do with an arbitrary physical theory. So this is literally just asking the most coarse-grained separation you could imagine. When classically are there things that you can't do even though you've satisfied all the conditional independences?
So you think you don't require it to exist in some operational theory? You don't require that some operational theory would yield
So it could be that some of these scenarios that we're saying are interesting in this sense might not be have the stronger sense of interesting, which is actually having a separation between classical and quantum, or even between classical and arbitrary physical theories. We're just talking about the separation between classical and mere conditional independence.
which of these structures have consequences beyond its initial intent.
Yeah.
But then when I would have expected that your separable, you know, replacing tangle state with a separable state, that figure, I would have expected that would have been an example of an interesting structure because, yeah, because there are constraints that go beyond its initial dependencies here, you know, namely the bounding qualities. Like I can think of I as a hidden variable, and so there's going to be limitations on the
coordinate. Once. Because one of the observable conditional independences here is that A and B is independent given I.
Yeah, I see. I can't act as a variable because it's
yeah, the hidden variable has been revealed, and so there's no longer anything except conditional independence.
So it really is a question that would appeal to all the classical guys, which is just in what circumstance, if, for what DAGs, are there consequences of the causal structure for the strengths of the correlations, not just
But since we know that things like quantum theory still have to satisfy the conditional independence, it needs to be interesting in this sense for it to be interesting in the quantum foundational sense. Yeah?
Can you go back to the theorem? I'm just trying to understand.
Are you talking about the
generalization of the
deseparation thing? I don't really have a slide that actually states the theorem. When we draw a DAG like this, we just put random variables on the triangular nodes. So X, A, B, C, and Z are all random variables, and then the thing that you're supposed to measure or the thing that your theory is supposed to predict is some probability distribution over those five variables, okay? And then we've defined a notion of when that probability distribution is compatible with this causal structure given a certain physical theory. And then our theorem is if you've satisfied that definition, then that probability distribution on those five guys has to have any conditional independence that follows from deseparation.
Right.
So it's purely a statement about a probability distribution over five variables.
Let's say we apply it to the original Valentine.
Yeah.
Classically, it would have told us some inequality.
No. No, because I'm not putting it.
So in your theorem, what's different? In other words, when the past, there's still a past for A to B.
Yeah. So
you don't regard it as being a blocking thing because it's a circle.
No. A path is allowed to go through a circular node.
Yeah.
But since there's no variable on a circular node, you can't condition on a circular node.
No, I know,
so the path from A to B, there's still a path from A to B. It goes through the circular node, but you can't block it by conditioning on it because we haven't put a variable there for
you
to condition on.
That as a block. You just don't allow yourself to condition on it.
We're not even defining what it might mean to condition on it. We're only putting variables on the triangular nodes. And we're just talking about the conditional independences that hold on those variables.
Then this is not, this might be related to what Rob was saying, but this is not a generalization of the notion of screening off or whatever you want to call this conditional independence. Isn't what one was hoping for quantum mechanically would be a generalization of that?
Yeah, so Matt and Rob.
This is not offering that.
No. Matt and Rob hope to have some sense where even if you're violating a Bell inequality, there's still some sense in which once you condition on the entangled state or on the entangled source, that in some new definition of conditional independence, it's true that the outcomes are conditional independent. We're not even attempting to tackle that. We're just talking about plain old standard conditional independence on classical probability distributions. And we forget about the old sense. Yeah.
And that's what the deseparation theorem is trivial in one direction, right? That if you're only interested in reproducing conditional intensities on the classical nodes, then you could just, you know, any deseparation relations that hold among classical nodes will apply conditional intensities on them. Is that correct? If I marginalize over all of the latent nodes, then I should just have a probability distribution over the rest of them.
It's not trivial that that will have the right conditional independences. It's trivial that it won't have any further conditional, or that it might not have any further conditional independences, because it could have been that you just used one of the classical examples where there's no further conditional independences. But if what actually happened was there was some entangled state, entangled measurements, yada, 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 then the classical thing doesn't tell you anything about which independences hold. Yes, I guess. Yeah. A triangle with an arrow to a circle with a triangle to an arrow. Triangle with an arrow to a circle with an arrow to a triangle is a boring DAG. It implies no conditional independences, and classically you can achieve anything. Well, I mean, it depends on your physical theory. If your physical theory is like only has noisy preparations and measurements in it. Yes, the only, since you can't condition on a circular node, the only use they can be in deseparation is if there's a path that's head-to-head on them. For anything else, the circular node is not going to be where the block is because you can't condition on it.
Have you given any thought to generalizing the framework such that you could condition on the node? Is that orthogonal to what you're doing?
I wouldn't say it's orthogonal. I mean, it would make proving deseparation a lot easier, for example. That seems to be quite hard. It's a bit more hairy than that. I can tell you about it later. Or the paper should be out any week now.